TV junkies who like their antiheroes will recognize this next voice.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
And the one who knocks is, of course, Walter White from the AMC series Breaking Bad. We have some good news for fans looking to get a new fix of the show. Walter is back in Spanish.
Yo soy el que toca la puerta. Yo no estoy en peligro. Yo soy el peligro.
Hansi Lo Wong of NPR's Code Switch team reports on the Spanish language version of Breaking Bad that will air its finale tomorrow night.
How do you remake an award-winning cable TV masterpiece in Spanish? Well, all you need is, as Walter White might say,
a little tweak of chemistry.
You can start with a new theme song, but keep the original dialogue and translate almost word for word.
That's right.
Eso pensé.
Now.
Ahora sí.
Say my name.
Diga mi nombre.
Okay, fine. I'll say your name, Walter Blanco. Or at least, that's what they call you in Unimas' Breaking Bad remake, Metastases.
It's kind of an analogy of how the drugs expand the same way as cancer does.
Diego Trujillo stars as the chemistry teacher with lung cancer who becomes a drug dealer in Bogota, Colombia.
I've always worked in television, doing soap operas here in Colombia. And the characters I've played are always predictable. But the character of Walter White is so complex.
Just like the English language version, Metastases begins with Walter facing a midlife crisis.
He starts with his 50th birthday, underestimated in his work. He's got a sick son. He's expecting a baby they never planned. And suddenly he finds out he's got cancer.
Walter. Walter.
Walter's cancer diagnosis acts as a wake-up call that eventually leads him to cooking crystal meth with a former student.
Jose Miguel Rosas.
Jose Miguel Rosas, that's the Spanish language version of Jesse Pinkman for Breaking Bad fans. In Metastases, Jose is played by Roberto Urbina, who says he's a die-hard fan of the original series. Did you binge watch or what?
Binge watch completely. I would stay up until 5 o'clock in the morning.
Urbina says Metastases changes some details to make the story more believable in Latin America. Walter teaches at a private, not public school, and he and Jose cook meth inside an old school bus instead of an RV. Setting the show in Bogota rather than Albuquerque, New Mexico, had other implications.
The drug dealing aspect of it had to be very carefully thought out. Because Colombia is a country that has a history of drug dealing. So people there in our reality, we're very touchy when it comes to that subject.
Drug dealing is a major plot point in the series, but its themes about morality and family are what hooked viewers like Laura Martinez. She's a Spanish language media critic and editor for CNET en Español when she heard about Metastases.
Well, my first reaction was, this is ridiculous. I don't need a Hispanic Breaking Bad. We already have a regular Breaking Bad.
But after watching the show, Martinez says she changed her mind.
It is not the first time we adapt a series in Latin America, but I think it is the first time that is done with such care.
The remake's production values also impressed Brian Delgado, a high school senior in Los Angeles who's been following Metastases since it debuted in June. He says he's watched all 62 episodes of Breaking Bad 5 times, and even got his parents, who grew up in Mexico, to start binging with him, although they had trouble waiting months for the last episodes.
Once they finished the first half of the season 5, it was hell for them, because they were so used to watching telenovelas.
Those Spanish language soap operas air several times a week, and so has Metastases. But Brian Delgado's parents prefer the original version of Breaking Bad when it's dubbed in Spanish. For Brian, though, there is no wrong choice.
Either way, you know, Breaking Bad or Metastases, I think you're in for a treat.
AMC will treat Breaking Bad fans to a spin-off series in February. It follows Walter White's lawyer, Saul Goodman.
I'm Saul Goodman, and I'll fight for you. So you better call Saul.
Though Metastases viewers better call him Saul Bueno. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
It's one of the peculiarities of our age that a show that's appeared on many critics' lists as one of the best new shows of the fall TV season isn't really a TV show. Transparent tells the story of a transgender person, played by Jeffrey Tambor, who comes out to her adult children.
Are you saying that you're going to start dressing up like a lady all the time?
Honey, all my life, I've been dressing up like a man.
Transparent is not a broadcast show. It's being released online by Amazon. All 10 episodes will be available on Friday, so if you're like me, you can binge. The show's creator, Jill Soloway, is a veteran TV producer with shows like 6 Feet Under and the United States of Tara under her belt. A lot of her work is focused on gender issues. Soloway's father is transgender, so you might think that's behind her interest. But when she came by NPR West, Jill told me that her father only came out several years ago, long after she started writing about these issues.
A lot of people sort of talk about art as a way that the soul expresses itself, that you can really learn a lot about your unconscious by just looking at what you create. It's the unspoken parts of the soul, the unspoken parts of the self that when expressed in art will often feel really resonant. You know, people will say, oh, it just wrote itself. I think a lot of times those are expressing things that are there that we don't know, have words for yet. Mm-hmm. And so for me to find out that after probably 3 decades, if not 4 decades, of struggling with questions about gender, it was actually kind of exciting and kind of freeing to know that I had this legacy of gender queerness in my family.
Let's hear a little bit from the show. This is the Jeffrey Tambor character, Mort, who becomes Maura. He's in a group therapy situation talking about something that he'd experienced.
And the girl at the cash register said,
I need to see some ID with that credit card of yours. And you know what that's like, right? And I just knew this is going to not be good. This is going to get ugly. And so she just kept looking at me. And then she said, oh. And I didn't, I was like, do not cry in front of this woman. Do not cry in front of this woman.
You're dealing with transgendered people. This is still an area which, where feelings are still kind of raw in a lot of ways. There's still a very active debate where people can get offended
so much.
Over.
I need to correct a few things you've already said in this interview.
Please.
No offense, but just so you understand, when you said that the character was talking about his experience in a store and he was in a support group, that you could actually use the pronoun she or they, but not he to refer to Maura. Even though the actor is male, the character is female, so we use the pronoun she or they for Maura. And then you just use the word transgendered, which is actually not considered the correct word is transgender people.
Gotcha. Well, this is
We're all learning.
So,
I'm learning every day, and hopefully the audiences will begin to learn along with the Feffermans.
So how do you deal with this? Because I know that pretty much from the moment this was being conceived, you were under the scrutiny of a lot of people.
Yes, there's a very vocal trans activist presence on the internet, and thank God for them, and thank God for the kind of feedback, really, because the world knows so little about being trans, and I know very little about being trans. I just know what it's like to be the child of a trans person. But there's so little trans representation. There's so few trans people who are creating content. So we really depend on the trans community to help us get it right. And, you know, we're happy to be corrected. And we have trans consultants on the show. We had a whole bunch of trans people hired on the show. We're using it not only as, you know, a job and a comedy and a drama and a piece of TV, but we're creating our own little civil rights movement here in Hollywood.
Have you been getting a hard time from anybody by casting Jeffrey Tambor as a transgender
character? As a trans woman. Yes, and I really understand why. I think when I first wanted to cast Jeffrey Tambor, it was really because he reminded me of my parent, and I always had Jeffrey Tambor in my mind for this role as soon as I started conceiving of the show. I think that was really from a very naive place where I really didn't understand the grave, grave problems of the lack of trans representation on television. There are just so few trans people playing trans people. It's really a shame that there wasn't that trans actress that I could have cast in the role in that moment. So since then, I really did become educated and become politicized to the problem of what it means to cast a cis male in a trans woman role. We did cast a bunch of other trans roles. We had 15 other speaking parts for trans people.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about the new
production model where, you know, Netflix and in your case, you know, Amazon are directly producing work like this. Do you think you could have pitched this to a network and would it have worked in the old system?
I don't really think it would have. I mean, I don't think it could have. It feels very, very, very new. I think there are a lot of things about this moment that feel so perfect. For Amazon to binge release these so that it's all 10, you can take 5 hours and take it all in at once, is really just a great way to allow an artist to kind of go deep and make one really big piece of art that I can kind of put my hands around and go, here it all is.
It's really hard just to watch one of these.
Oh, good.
I wasn't able to.
Okay, yeah, you kept going, huh?
Yeah.
Love that. Yeah, I'm hoping people will watch all 10 and then maybe watch all 10 again.
That's Jill Soloway. She's the creator and director of the new show Transparent. You can watch the pilot show now on Amazon Prime, and the rest of the series will premiere this Friday. Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, CBS follows 60 Minutes with two drama series about women juggling family lives and high-intensity jobs. One is a new series called Madam Secretary, starring Taya Leone as a college professor asked to step into the White House as the new Secretary of State. The other series is the returning drama The Good Wife, starring Juliana Margulies as a lawyer who, in last year's season-ending cliffhanger, was asked to run for state's attorney of Illinois. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, is going to review both shows.
My first impression of Madam Secretary, back when CBS presented a brief highlights reel when the new series was announced in May, was a good one. In fact, it was a great one. It had Taya Leone returning to television in a show that looked like a perfect fit to be paired with the smart, female-driven drama The Good Wife. Set in the White House, in the corridors of power, Madam Secretary, at first glance, had the feel, the look, and even the energy and potential of The West Wing, TV's all-time best series about national politics. But then I previewed the entire Madam Secretary opening episode, which premiered Sunday night, preceding and paired with the season 6 opener of The Good Wife. And while I love the cast of Madam Secretary, almost every role is played by someone who's done excellent work on TV, the writing and the unfolding storylines just keep spiraling downward and becoming more disappointing. The show, created by Barbara Hall from Joan of Arcadia, starts with a strongly presented setup, but never manages to live up to it. Here's one of the earliest scenes from Madam Secretary. It's when Elizabeth McCord, a college professor played by Taya Leone, gets a surprise visitor at her home. The President of the United States, played by Keith Carradine. The Secretary of State has just died in a plane crash. And in Elizabeth's kitchen, the President explains the reason for his visit. The scene is well acted, but not particularly well written.
The death of Vincent Marsh is catastrophic on many levels. It's a bad time to be without diplomatic representation.
Because of the peace talks with Iran and President Shiraz's upcoming visit to the U.S.?
So you understand why I can't waste any time on this decision. I want you to step in.
Step into what?
Secretary of State.
You're joking. I don't mean you're joking, but you can't be serious. Obviously you're serious. Why?
I recruited you for the CIA. I trained you as an analyst. I know how you think, how you work. I trust you.
After that scene, Madam Secretary jumps forward 2 months, so Elizabeth is well into her new job. In one way, it's a bold choice, because it skips the usual introductions of a new workplace and a new set of characters. But in another way, it avoids the difficulties inherent in staging those very scenes and establishing the conflicts. After the 2 month leap forward in time, the conflicts already are there, and we viewers are asked to catch up. In the end, there's at least one conflict too many, with a running subplot introduced that throws a conspiracy theory into the already convoluted mix. There were two ways this show's producers, who include the actor Morgan Freeman, could have gone with Madam Secretary. The series could emulate the intelligence of NBC's The West Wing, or focus on the soap opera excesses of ABC's Scandal. Despite a gold standard supporting cast that includes Tim Daly, Bebe Neuwirth, and Zeljko Ivanek, Madam Secretary opts for the Scandal route. The Good Wife, on the other hand, features some of the smartest writing on television right now, and many of the smartest characters. Series creators Robert and Michelle King made last year's season 5 the show's best yet, with the sudden death of one main character and the continuing shuffling of the relationships, both professional and personal, among all the others. Cable and streaming TV may be where almost all the action is on television these days. But The Good Wife holds the fort for broadcast TV beautifully. Last season ended with a quiet but stunning cliffhanger, as Eli Gold, the governor's political advisor played so brilliantly by Alan Cumming, asked Alicia Florek, the wife of his boss, an unexpected question after a small holiday dinner at her home, while music is played in the background. This season's premiere episode on Sunday picks up seconds later with her answer, and we're off. It's a scene similar to the one from Madam Secretary, except it's so much more gripping and more real. Juliana Margulies, who just won her second Emmy for the role, stars as Alicia. And when Eli pops his question, surprising them both, Alicia's response is to get up from the dinner table and begin clearing and rinsing dishes, retreating into a more comfortable role as homemaker.
Alicia.
Yes?
Would you want to run for state's attorney?
What?
Would you want to run for state's attorney?
No.
Why not?
Why not? Eli, are you serious?
Yes. I've been watching you for the last 5 years. You'd be perfect. We need a woman. And people respect you. They like you.
I'm not a politician, Eli.
But you have political instincts. And you're a brand. You're Saint Alicia. Well, you said yourself you want something new. The empty nest syndrome. Zach's gone now.
Yes, and I have another child. Is this about Peter? Did he tell you to ask me?
No.
Then why are you doing this? I'm never saying yes.
Because you could win.
All these years in, I don't have to spend much time raving about why I love The Good Wife. The legal cases they dramatize are as intelligent and as multi-layered as the characters. And the acting, from the guest stars as well as the regulars, is marvelous. Each week on The Good Wife, the show's opening credits don't show up until about 10 minutes into the show. And they always catch me by surprise, because by that time, I'm so involved with the plot, I forget that the credits haven't run yet. But when they arrive, with flair and a bit of dramatic punctuation, they always remind me, week in and week out, that I'm watching one of TV's best dramas. Madam Secretary, by being paired with The Good Wife on Sunday nights, suffers badly by comparison.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of the debut of The Cosby Show. A new biography of its co-creator and star was just released. It's called Cosby, His Life and Times. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans spoke with author Mark Whitaker about the man whose comedy has had a huge impact on America's ideas about family and race.
The Cosby Show rarely sounded like a situation comedy that was transforming network television, especially because the situations, often centered on parents Cliff and Claire Huxtable, seem so ordinary.
I was a beautiful woman once, before the children came.
I just hope they get out of the house before we die.
But author Mark Whitaker says scenes like this subtly revolutionized TV. They showed an upper-middle-class black family strongly connected to their culture.
There was more blackness in that show than people either acknowledge at the time or remember, but it was always done in a very subtle and specific way without trying to call attention to it.
Like the African-American art on their walls and the jazz music playing in their home. Whitaker, a former editor of Newsweek, has written the first major biography to get cooperation from Cosby himself. And in telling Cosby's life story, it details how The Cosby Show grew out of his comedy style, which focuses on storytelling about universal themes. For example, one of Cosby's biggest routines from the 1960s was about Noah and God.
Noah!
What?
What do you want?
You got two males down there and you need to bring in a female.
I'm not bringing nothing in. You change one of them.
There were people in the 60s who thought he should be addressing racial issues in his comedy. Cosby always had a sense, a very deep sense, of the impact that his work was going to have on race relations.
That impact grew in 1965 when producer Sheldon Leonard cast Cosby in a groundbreaking new show called I Spy. I Spy featured Cosby and Robert Culp as a team of hip undercover agents. It was the first time a black man co-starred in a TV drama. And it wouldn't have been possible without white supporters like Culp and Leonard, something Whitaker says Cosby appreciated greatly.
He even had a term for his white supporters and mentors. He called them abolitionists.
Fans who weren't used to seeing Cosby talk about race were likely shocked when he took the stage at a 2004 NAACP event to deliver the pound cake speech, an off-the-cuff criticism of poor black people for failing to better themselves.
People getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. And then we all run out and we're outraged. Oh, the cop shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand?
Whitaker notes that Cosby overcame similar challenges himself, which included growing up poor with an absentee alcoholic father.
You know, I think Cosby's message underneath all of the comedy all along has been, if black folks want to be respected, they have to respect themselves.
But Michael Eric Dyson, an educator and pundit, spoke out against the remarks and eventually wrote a book called Is Bill Cosby Right, or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind?
I thought he was being elitist and condescending and dismissive of the poor and uncomprehending about their lives. Then we talked and he said, look, I was really quoted out of context. And so he sent me a copy of the speech. And when I heard it, it was venomous. It was acerbic. The tone of the speech was nasty and brutal.
Dyson says Whitaker has been seduced by Cosby. He notes the biography doesn't mention a jarring accusation from 2004 when several women claimed the comic drugged and sexually assaulted them.
So how is it that the accusations of immorality that have been levied against Mr. Cosby don't make it into a book where the author defends Mr. Cosby in terms of his own attacks on young people?
Whitaker, who did write about times when Cosby cheated on his wife, said he never asked his subject directly about the assault allegations or interviewed the accusers. As a journalist, Whitaker says he wasn't comfortable including complex accusations in the book that he couldn't prove.
And I just did not want to be in a position of printing allegations and denials and then be in a position as a journalist writing the most thorough biography that's ever been done. If people said to me, well, what do you think really happened? And I would say, you know, I don't know.
A representative for Bill Cosby declined an interview request for this story. The book does note that Cosby's show may even have made it easier for all Americans to picture a black family like the Obamas in the White House. That may be the most enduring legacy of The Cosby Show and Cosby himself, indirectly challenging stereotypes by telling stories that moved a nation. Eric Deggans, NPR News.